Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Bruce Ortega from the California Attorney General's Office, and I represent the appellant and the cross-appellee in this case, the State of California. With the Court's permission, what I would like to do is open for 10 minutes and reserve the remaining 10 minutes both to make rebuttal on my appeal and to respond to any contentions that the petitioner may make on the cross-appeal.
Very well.
There are numerous issues in this case, numerous hurdles I frankly acknowledge that I have to overcome to prevail. I can't possibly address all of them, nor would I attempt to, so I thought what I would do is spend my time addressing the first issue, and that is the State Court of Appeals' conclusion that the introduction of the diary, the victim's diary in this case, into evidence was not a Confrontation Clause violation, and the district court's ruling that the State Court of Appeals' determination was an unreasonable application of Idaho v. Wright and Ohio v. Roberts, which mandate that hearsay satisfies the Confrontation Clause only when there is adequate indicia of reliability such that adversarial testing would be of minimal utility.
This is a habeas case. Judge Alsup found that, or at least held, that that the California Court of Appeals determination was contrary to established federal law.
Unreasonable application.
Unreasonable application.
Correct. Right. And as Your Honor pointed out in a recent decision in Clark v. Murphy, an unreasonable application is an objectively unreasonable one. And Your Honor wrote, while the objectively unreasonable standard is not self-explanatory, at a minimum it denotes a greater degree of deference to the state courts than we have previously afforded them. Judge Alsup, because Clark v. Murphy was after Lockyer, which was after the decision in our case, applied the previous standard of deference on AEDPA habeas, that being the Van Tran standard, that objective unreasonableness is clear error.
Well, the Van Tran standard is out now.
Correct. So the question becomes now, under the even greater degree of deference due state court determinations, was the state court decision that this diary had adequate indicia of reliability objectively unreasonable in light of Ohio v. Roberts and Idaho v. Wright? And we would suggest that the three reasons that the Court of Appeal relied upon are not objectively unreasonable, the first being that there was no indication that Mary's diaries were made in contemplation of pending or anticipated litigation such as divorce. Now, we acknowledge that in December of 1993, she was thinking of divorce, but there was no evidence that she was keeping these diaries in contemplation of any possible divorce litigation. As the State Court of Appeal concluded, it appears Mary's diaries were made as part of her regular process of recording the events in her life. And that was supported, that's supported in the record by the testimony of her son, who stated that she had been keeping diaries since about 1960. The second factor the Court of Appeal relied upon was that there was no indication that Mary had a motive for fabricating anything she wrote or bias. Now, we recognize that both the district court and the petitioner take great exception to that. It's their position that many of the diary entries themselves, the language and the tenor, show bias. For example, Mary writes, "He's a beast. He's a person who is not going to do me right. He's aged me 20 years and five. He's cut me down to a toothpick." The petitioner in the district court stated that that's every indication that she was biased, and the cross-examination would have been of utility here. Our response is twofold. One, we have to recognize that the hearsay exception this came in under, California 1370, is an exception for statements that purport to narrate, describe, or explain the infliction of threat of physical injury upon the declarant. And given that, there's necessarily going to be language that shows anger, because generally speaking, domestic violence victims are angry at the perpetrator. We think the issue is whether, or what is the extent of the bias, and whether there's other indicia of trustworthiness here. And we think that that's shown by the fact that, along with all of the damning assertions she makes about petitioner, she self-incriminates. She writes that she slashed him on the arm with a letter opener, and he was bleeding like a stuck pig. I got pissed and I went after him. I hit and I hit and I slapped him once good across the face. Another time she apologizes to the victim for lying to him. On two occasions, she states in the diary that she loves Petitioner. It's our view that all those are factors that at least keep the State Court of Appeals decision from being objectively unreasonable. What I would then do is I'll sit down.
Why don't you rest now, and we'll hear from Mr. Kresser, and then
thank you, Your Honor.
Respond to that. Mr. Kresser, good to see you again. We saw you earlier this week.
Yes, Your Honor. Good to be back. And good morning. Michael Kresser, appearing for the Appellee and Cross Appellant, Timothy Charles Parle, in this matter. Your Honor, is it possible for me to reserve some of my time on the issue that we are the cross appellant on?
If you wish.
Yes, I would like to do that. Addressing the issue of the confrontation, we look, of course, we start with the presumption from Idaho v. Wright and the Roberts v. Ohio case that hearsay is presumed to be unreliable, and that there must be circumstances indicating trustworthiness that are so strong that would indicate that cross-examination would be of marginal utility.
Counsel, remember, we're here on federal habeas, which has a much higher threshold, as you know. Help us figure out why the California Court of Appeals determination was unreasonable under federal law.
Certainly. I was just trying to identify the controlling United States Supreme Court federal precedent that this issue must be analyzed under, recognizing clearly that as a state habeas petitioner under 28 U.S.C. 2254d, that, yes, we have the burden of showing an unreasonable, that the decision of the State Court of Appeal here was contrary to or an unreasonable application of this controlling precedent, or involved an unreasonable determination of fact, which I think also comes into play in this case. The thing is that to me it is a contrary to situation that we have here, because if you look at the State Court of Appeals decision, it never really identifies the correct legal principle that the degree of trustworthiness that must be shown is such that would render cross-examination of marginal utility. And it takes this statute, this California Evidence Code statute, and it deals with the two factors that are enumerated there, which are not exclusive even under the terms of the statute, nor could they be exclusive under the controlling U.S. Supreme Court precedent. So we have this whole point: was it done in contemplation of litigation? Was there a was there an indication of bias or motive? And then the state court also adds, as its only positive, seemingly, finding as to trustworthiness, that this was a regularly kept diary. Now, I'd like to go to that whole question of bias and motive, because I think right here we have a finding of the state court that there was no evidence of bias here. And I think this is totally contrary to the record that was before the state court. We have a person here who, within contemporaneous with these diary entries, was committing acts such as criminally vandalizing Mr. Parle's automobile, going out, slashing all four tires on his car, beating his car with a hammer. This is a person who, roughly contemporaneous with this, took an overdose of drugs and was involuntarily hospitalized as a danger to herself or others due to her mental state. These are indications of a bias, a motive, untrustworthiness that come out from this record. We have the evidence that was excluded, which I'll get to a little bit later, that she had told the nurse while she was involuntarily hospital about her feelings of anger and vindictiveness toward
Mr.
Paul.
But doesn't this always, doesn't, at the end of the day, doesn't this come down to an interpretation of Wright, Idaho versus Wright? The California court read it one way, Judge Alsup read it another. help us sort that out.
Well, Idaho versus Wright says you must have circumstances indicating trustworthiness that are so strong that it rebuts the presumption of unreliability, and basically you have to show that cross-examination would be of marginal utility. All right? And basically the state court did much as Mr. Ortega does. They read it. They say, gee, it seems plausible to me. That's good enough. All right? But if you look at Idaho versus Wright, that's not the test. That's not the proper analysis. You must look at the circumstances of the making of the statement. And Idaho versus Wright cautioned about looking at the contents of the statement and then comparing it to other evidence in the trial for corroboration. They say that is improper. That's not correct analysis under this, under the Confrontation Clause.
Whether there's a motive for fabricating.
Yes.
Certainly this diary doesn't indicate as a motive for fabricating and the writing of her diary. It seems to be a stream of consciousness. Sometimes it's very pro the defendant, sometimes very anti the defendant. I love him. I hate him. You know, it doesn't seem to me the kind of bias that you look for in determining whether a written document should come in.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that if this person is committing criminal acts of vandalism against the person, that you've got a pretty strong indication of bias and
motive to lie in her diary.
Well, we have these assertions here, for example, that she blames him for the fact that she's been in 3 auto accidents in the last year. Where is that coming from exactly? She's blaming him, say that she was put in the loony bin on account of him, when all the evidence indicates that her stay in the loony bin was prompted by her own overdose and the opinions of psychiatric people that she was mentally disordered to the point that she was a danger to herself or others.
Looking at the diary, you can tell she's certainly not stable.
Right.
I don't think that's the same thing as being that you have a motive.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I would have to respectfully disagree with that. I think that this basically is the diary, as it appears, is her way of putting this all into her slant on the relationship, on what the causes of their problems are. It's no more trustworthy than if she'd have just sat and told her friend what her opinions were or things that had happened. It's rank hearsay. And there's nothing about the circumstances of its preparation that indicate this degree of trustworthiness that the Idaho versus Wright decision demands. Where are the circumstances indicating trustworthiness so strongly that it matches up with a firmly rooted hearsay exception? They're not there.
Counsel, you may want to go on to your cross-appeal.
Yes. Let me discuss that as well. There's a second issue kind of intervening here, which also is the fact that the writ was granted by Judge Alsup on 2 grounds. 1, the confrontation, and then 2, also the other grounds, the other evidence that was helpful to the defense and highly probative that was also excluded by the trial judge in this case. The State Court of Appeal held, yes, it was probative. No, it shouldn't have been excluded, but then declined to analyze this under federal constitutional principles, applied the more lenient state test of prejudice, and nonetheless affirmed the convictions. But these are very important portions.
But wasn't there plenty of evidence of threats that came in anyway, not necessarily the specific hearsay objections which were upheld?
Well, the threat evidence that was excluded in this this kind of second issue, if you will, was the evidence of it was really more of the evidence of the vindictiveness that had been expressed to the nurse, number 1, and then number 2, you have the psychiatric testimony that was excluded, that the defense put on and asked perfectly relevant questions that would have adduced probative evidence in favor of the appellant as to the effect, potential effect of his manic disorder, which he had been diagnosed with, was under treatment for at the time of the homicide, and yet the trial judge would not let this evidence be introduced. And then the prosecutor, in closing argument, exploited this erroneous ruling that he had obtained from the trial judge. And when trial counsel tried to argue the impact of the manic disorder on defendant's state of mind at the time of the homicide, successfully objected, got all of it stricken, and basically informed the jury there was no evidence to support that. So we have yet these other important pieces of defense evidence that were wrongly excluded. Even the State Court of Appeal said they were wrongly excluded. They were probative to the defense. And
well, they weren't hearsay. That was the real problem. They excluded this hearsay. Put in for the truth of the matter of the statements. Put in to show how the man reacted to these statements, whether they were true or not.
Well, I'm really focusing here, Your Honor, on the psychiatric testimony of Dr. Jackman that was going to be very helpful to the defense. That was wrongly excluded. It was probative. It was very helpful to the defense, and yet it was erroneously excluded. And this was a second ground that the district court relied upon in granting the writ. The cumulative impact of the first error, although the Judge Alsop said the first error in and of itself, yes, the admission of the diary would justify the writ, but he also went on to address the fact that there was other errors of exclusion of defense evidence that also justified issuance of the writ.
Now, the cumulative impact issue per se was not the subject of a COA. There was no COA on that issue, was there?
Well, we won that issue, Your Honor. So the court, if you review Judge Alsop's decision, he grants the writ both on the confrontation issue solely and then in conjunction with the other errors of exclusion of highly probative defense evidence. So we won on those issues.
Well, that's right.
Right.
He held your way. But
yes.
The question was he permitted to get into that issue given the fact there was no separate issue preserved under the COA? The COA had two issues. As you pointed out, the confrontation issue and the exclusion.
Do you mean the original habeas petition?
No, I'm talking about the COA, the Certificate of Appealability.
Yes.
From Judge Alsop.
Right. That we sought one on the single ground that we were denied on. We were granted on two grounds, denied on the third ground, and we sought a COA once the people appealed. Then we sought a COA on the single issue that we lost upon. So
you don't think there's a problem about looking at the cumulative error issue
for this court to
to
look at it?
Yeah.
None whatsoever. I don't
All
see
right.
any procedural
okay.
barrier
right.
or I don't understand my opponent to be raising any barrier to that. Let me finally get to the issue of the violation of Mr. Parle's right to testify on his own behalf. Here, when Mr. Parle took the stand to testify in his own defense, clearly one of the key points, we have this terribly tumultuous, mutually violent relationship that had gone on between this married couple for many years. And it certainly was, it involved violence on the part of both parties, threats on the part of both parties. And a crucial question that had to be addressed by the defense was, well, after all of this that had gone on before, why now did you honestly, if perhaps unreasonably, believe that your life was in danger from his wife? And the crucial point on this was the fact that she had escalated her threats. And the key portion of this was a phone call that she had made to Mr. Parle. It was Monday, I believe the homicide occurred on a Friday. And in this one, she was threatened to do a drive-by shooting on the home and to kill Mr. Parl and their son. Now, this evidence was perfectly admissible under California law. Once again, the prosecutor persuaded the trial court to make yet another erroneous ruling in his favor and got the trial court to repeatedly sustain totally erroneous hearsay objections during defendant's testimony. This was a crucial portion of his testimony. Something like 9 times the prosecutor objected, and the court erroneously sustained these objections. This had, I would invite the court to read this portion of the record during defendant's testimony, whereas there's the series of meritless objections that keep getting sustained, and the testimony keeps getting stricken. It had a very serious impact on Mr. Parle's testimony. He's at one point says out loud, "How can I answer the question without giving hearsay?" He's visibly struggling to try to answer the question truthfully and yet comply with the court's rulings. He asks to speak with the judge. He asks to speak with the jury. I mean, this is how great a distress that this series of erroneous rulings caused the defendant and the defense. It was a complete a misapplication of the state hearsay rule, and it amounted to an arbitrary infringement on his right to testify in violation of Rock versus Arkansas. Rock versus Arkansas said any time that, you know, a defendant obviously has a very crucial constitutional right to take the stand in his own defense, if the state imposes arbitrary restrictions on this testimony, then there has been a federal constitutional violation. That's exactly what occurred in this case. And the Attorney General, the State Court of Appeal, and, yes, even the District Court basically said, well, yes, but there was some other evidence of threats. And so keeping this out really wasn't of that great importance. And yet when you step back and you look at the entire defense, this was an extremely crucial point to show how the nature of the threats had escalated dramatically in the week prior to the homicide.
Counsel, you may want to reserve, if you wish.
I would like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Ortega.
Thank you, Your Honors. This case is confusing procedurally, so let me see if I can clear up perhaps some of the Court's thinking on the cumulative error. The District Court granted the writ not only because it found the Confrontation Clause violation prejudicial, but then on a second ground, a cumulative error ground, it granted the writ. The District Court found that the Confrontation Clause violation combined with 2 other errors mandated granting the writ. Because what in this case, the State Court of Appeal found 5 errors, 4 of which were of state law variety, 1 of which was of federal constitutional variety, not including the Confrontation Clause. It found no error.
All right, but the question is, and maybe you agree with counsel, the question is, was the cumulative error challenge preserved in the COA? Was there a COA on that issue?
The government doesn't have to get a COA.
I know.
He granted the writ on that cumulative error ground. I would be challenging the cumulative error ground. The judge did not grant the COA for the petitioner
right.
on the cumulative error ground because the judge ruled in
therefore,
his favor.
Therefore, is there jurisdiction? That's my question.
I believe you have jurisdiction.
All right. Well, then you agree.
But,
right.
Except that my position is that if this court were to find that there was no Confrontation Clause violation, then what do we do with the cumulative error ruling by Judge Alsup? Because he included the Confrontation Clause error in it.
Right. In other words, the question is, do we simply reverse on your assumption, or do we reverse and then remand for further proceedings with respect to the cumulative error issue?
That's what I suggested should happen, because my reading of the law is a harmless error, a cumulative error analysis is a mixed question, and I felt like, well, Judge Alsup should have the first go at determining whether there's cumulative error here taking out one of the prongs he found cumulative error on. In petitioner's briefing, they say, no, they don't want that. It's all ripe here. Your honors can make a ruling on the cumulative error issue apart from the confrontation clause. And I suppose that's correct because the court of appeal in this case made a cumulative error determination not including the confrontation clause violation.
How does it affect the mix if we find that there was error in not allowing the defendant to respond to the questions?
Okay.
How does that affect
that? Okay. Then if your honors find that, okay, then and your honors determine that, okay, let me step back, okay? I suppose the first question for your honors is if we find there's error in the rejection in the sustaining of the hearsay, was it prejudicial under Brecht?
And what if we find that?
Then I lose.
Okay.
Right. But I don't think that that's the case because I think, as Judge Alsup in the Court of Appeal noted, there was all sorts of other evidence that matched what petitioner wanted to say in the erroneous hearsay, including in the statements he made to the police, which were shown, and he was making the exact same statements. Mary was threatening me in a drive-by shooting. But again, if your honors were to find error and not prejudicial under Brecht on its own, your honors have to decide whether that's another reason to send it back for a cumulative error analysis by Judge Alsup. Because the state court...
But you also say even if we affirm on that issue, we still have to send it back.
That's how I understood.
All right. I just want to be sure I understand your argument.
But we don't have to send it back if we agree that the cross-examination or that the defendant was not improperly permitted to present his defense.
You'd have to find that the State Court of Appeal's determination was objectively unreasonable application of Rock.
Right.
And that it was prejudicial under Brecht.
Right. And that concludes the matter and he gets a new trial. Right?
That one issue would, irrespective of everything else. But as I won't get into any more with respect to that, other than to again note that it's not objectively unreasonable, as the Court of Appeal held here, or even Judge Alsup, when you factor in all the other evidence going to her threats and her actual violence. Now let me go back very quickly to the Confrontation Clause. And Mr. Kressler's position is, there was bias here, and he points to factors that happened after the making of the statement. Her behavior that had nothing to do with the making of the statement. When you look at the statement itself, is there evidence in there that would show reliability? Or, put another way, that would make it objectively reasonable for the state court to think so? And for all the reasons we articulated, we think so. We don't think you can look to evidence that Mary vandalized the car 2 months after she makes a diary entry to say the diary entry was unreliable. And not even Judge Alsup pointed to those factors. He looked only at the diary itself. Unless the court has any other questions, we'd submit it.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kressler, comments limited to the cross appeal only.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Again, going to the point of the prejudicial impact under the substantial injurious effect of the restriction of the defendant's testimony in this case. We look at the claims of Mr. Ortega this is just cumulative to other evidence. Once again, I want to point out the crucial nature of this evidence in light of the case as a whole, where you've got this background of mutual violence of a non-lethal variety, prior threats. Why did it end up that week, ending up the way it did? Why did he start fearing her in a way when in the past both the violence and the threats of violence were non-lethal? It's because they changed in character that week. That was extremely important. That came in no other way whatsoever. There is no other evidence that is that substitutes for that which was wrongfully excluded by the state court. And therefore, you cannot, it's not reasonable to say that it had no substantial and injurious effect. It had, and once again, ask the court to review that portion of the defendant's testimony. Even on a cold record, you see just how it absolutely stopped the defendant and the defense and right in the water. The series of objections, the series of striking, it left the defendant and defense counsel in a very bad position.
Did the jury have options for lesser included?
It did, Your Honor.
What were the jury's choices?
Jury's choices were either involuntary manslaughter, voluntary manslaughter, second-degree murder, or first-degree murder.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted for decision.